My name is Giorgio Moroder, and I was born in a small little village in Italy in April 1940, in the Dolomites actually, and not too far away from Austria or Switzerland. It's a town where we speak half German, half Italian, half Ladino, which is a very unique language, similar to Italian and French. It's a very old language. It comes directly from the Latin. My mommy called me Hansjörg. So some people in the valley, in the town where I live, they still call me Hansjörg, which, by the way, I don't really like. So I use my real name, Giorgio, or Giovanni Giorgio, but that's too long, so I use half of my name, which is my real name, Giorgio. In that little town, there was no connection with the world outside. And my career, let's say, as a musician, started by pure coincidence. When I was 15, 16, when I really started to play guitar, I definitely wanted to become a musician. It was almost impossible because the dream was so big that I didn't see any chance, because I was living in a little town, was studying. And when I finally broke away from school and became a musician, I thought, well, now I may have a little bit of a chance, because all I really wanted to do is music, and not only play music, but compose music. And I was just ready to do one more exam in school when, in June, somebody asked me if I wanted to become a professional musician, because they had a job at Christmas and they needed a guitarist. So I did one bad thing, but it was great for me. I went to the city where I was supposed to do the exam. But the morning at 8 o'clock, when the lady where I was staying woke me up, I said, I don't want to go to the exam. If I don't go to the exam, I have to repeat the year. If I repeat the year, it's going to be terrible. So I said, okay, I don't want to redo the year. I want to become a musician. And that's how I decided to become a musician. And my parents were terribly upset. But then finally, I left when I was 19, and I started to become a so-called professional musician. In fact, I did my first recording as a composer and singer with some friends of mine. We had a mono recorder, and I played guitar. One guy did the drums on the table with some guy clapped, and so we did our first song. And I think there is a guy in Italy who still has a 45 disc of it, and next time I see him, I'm going to ask him for a copy. After a period of time, the life of a musician was really annoying, because we didn't work too much. Sometimes we worked 2 hours a day in the evening, so all day long we didn't know what to do. We were sitting around in coffee shops. So I said, I better start to work, because I still wanted to become a composer. So I bought two Revox recorders, the stereo one, and I had a very small little mixer from a technician in Zurich. He built it for me with a little echo, not a delay, but a reverb. I had a microphone, a guitar, and a bass. And so I started to record my songs, like recording on one, copying, and while copying, adding back and forth. So after like 2 years of work, I became quite good at that. I started to become really fast. And I had one or two songs which I finished, and then I decided maybe I should try to get a deal with a record company. So I sent those two or three songs to a friend of mine in Italy, and he said, well, you know, the songs are not that great, but we could give you a job as an engineer. So I said, okay, what shall I do? What can I do? I said, maybe to have a foot in the door is better than nothing. And so I accepted to work as an engineer. And after a month, I gave up the job as an engineer because I noticed that as an engineer, it's very difficult to become a composer because the guys don't take you serious as a composer. So I said, I have to get rid of it. I had enough money to live, and that helped my life immensely. After 2 months or 3 months, I had my first hit. I was listening a lot to Radio Luxembourg. That was the only station where they would present some American, some English songs. And I was very much into Elvis Presley, and at that time I always liked bubblegum. Like, one of my heroes was a group called Ohio Express. Yummy, 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 I love this kind of songs. So I did a song called Looky Looky, and I composed it, but I had great musicians in a studio with professionals. And it became a nice hit. It became a hit in France, big hit in Italy, hit in Spain. It was number one in Belgium. And that was my first hit as a bubblegum. At that time in Germany, they had already discotheques in 69, 70. So I would take my car, would go to a discotheque, sing maybe 30 minutes. I think I had about 7-8 songs. I would partially sleep in the car because I didn't want to drive home. And that helped me for about almost 2 years to survive in the beginning. I played from 19 up to, I think, 27, 28, basically with two guys. The group consisted of a piano, drum, me as a guitar, and we would play like 2-3 months at a time in various cities in Europe. And one thing I remember, we played in St. Moritz, and we heard that John Lennon was staying at the hotel. So, of course, we were trying everything to meet him. We would invite him, and no, he didn't do anything. He didn't come to see us. So I never saw him, but I heard him because we were staying in the same hotel. We had a small room, and I guess he had a nice suite. And I heard him compose songs. And I remember he was playing, zing, 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 playing guitar and singing. So for several afternoons, I heard him composing songs. I don't know which one, maybe there was one of the songs which became a hit, but it was quite interesting to hear through the wall how part of the Beatles composed the songs. Then I continued in the early 70s, partially in Berlin. Then Berlin became too closed. You know, at the time you couldn't drive more than half an hour, and Berlin was encircled with the wall and the Eastern Germany. So basically, I rarely left Berlin because it was too expensive. But on the other hand, it became really like claustrophobic because there was nothing to do. And a guy, the head of Ariola Record Company, came to see me in my little house where I had my little studio in the kitchen. And he saw it, and he was so impressed. He said, I give you 1,000 marks if you move to Munich and you can produce for us. So I said, that's perfect. I'm there in a week or two. So I left Berlin, yeah, in about 71, I think. And I started to produce for Ariola. And I had some minor hits and some really bad stuff. I just listened to some of the stuff, and it's embarrassing what I did. But you know, I made some money, so I was quite happy. But then I had the song Mendocino with this guy, Michael Holm, which then really sold more than 1 million copies. Arizona Man in 70, I had a kind of, you could call it a synthesizer, a little thing like this, metal, with a very thin keyboard with a stick, and you could play gong ti doot 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 doot. That was before the Moog, and I remember I loved, I did in a song we called Arizona Man. That was really my first kind of synthesized sound on a record. So then I recorded a song called Son of My Father, and that was the time when the Moog came out. I think it was 71. I remember when I heard Wendy Carlos' piece called Switch It On Bach, I loved the sound of the synthesizer. So a friend of mine told me there is a guy in Munich who has one. There were only two Moogs around, one in America, one in Germany. He was the director of the classical orchestra in Munich, Eberhard Schöner. So I went to his house, and he had a beautiful setup with four speakers and this huge Moog, you know, with all the cables and lights. And then he started to play me a song, which he recorded. And the song was all one note. He was a kind of a classical modern composer, and all I heard was boing, all those sounds like waves, and I said, wow, this is beautiful. But you know, after 20 minutes I thought, let's stop and let's talk. I was fascinated right at the beginning because it was so new and so many possibilities, so many sounds, and obviously already some sequencing. So he was not interested, so he left. So I was talking to his engineer, and I said, could I borrow, could you work for me for a song I want to do? And he said, yeah. He said, Eberhard, my boss doesn't really like it, but we can arrange for something. So I used him for quite a lot of recordings, but I think the owner of the synthesizer didn't really know. So with Son of My Father, I used the first time the Moog as a, not as a main, but as an instrument which played about four or five parts. I immediately thought this could be my new instrument. In fact, for quite some time I played it on every song, a little too much. In 1972, I built a studio in Munich in the second basement of a building called the Arabella House. And I must say, the studio was equipped very well. We had a 16-track Studer, we had Dolby. I remember we had one of the first digital delays. We had huge speakers from Kadak, which were weighing like half a ton each. We had a great atmosphere. The musicians and the act could record in the studio, and the people could sleep in the building, which was half hotel. So it was a beautiful setup, and for me it was great because I was on the second floor. I would just take the elevator and I would be in the studio. I was kind of lucky because a lot of English groups would book the studio because of taxes, so they all liked to record or in Paris or in Munich. So we had the Rolling Stones, we had Queen, we had, my first one was T-Rex, Mark Bolan. So sometime I had a problem in getting to work in the studio, because if the Rolling Stones would call and say, I need a studio, I had to give it to them. So one day I did a demo for Three Dog Night, and I needed three singers, American or English, with no accent. So I met Donna Summer and I met two other girls, American, and we recorded this demo song with the three girls. And so I told Donna Summer, who I loved, said, if you have an idea of lyrics, just tell me and we do it. So one day she came back and she said, oh, so something like, ooh, love to love you, baby, ooh, love to love you, baby. And I said, wow, that's a great line. And I always had the idea to do a song, a really sexy song. I loved Serge Gainsbourg's song, Je t'aime moi non plus. So that particular day, the studio was available, so I went down there with a guitar and we did, we just played the melodies Before We Forget It. And we did a demo. And after, I wanted her to moan a little bit and see how it would work. And it did not work well. So probably the reason was that her husband was in the studio. I was there. Pete Bellotti was there. The engineer was there. So the only way to make it possibly work was to get everybody out. I took the lights down. I could see her a little bit in the face. She could see me a little bit. And that was Love to Love You Baby. And we released it, and it was a slight little hit, but nothing special. But then one night, Neil Bogart called me and said, Giorgio, last night I was at a party and I would put up this long Love to Love You song, and it was an instant success. He said, oh, wow, this is great. It's outrageous. It's new. Everybody wanted to hear it again and again. And so would you mind to do a long version of the song? So I said, great, nothing better, because to release an album was a great thing. And at the time, I only had a single. So we went back to the studio and we extended the 3.5-minute version. So that song became number one, basically, in the world, especially in America. It was one of the first songs which was not only played in discotheques, but played on the radio too. Not in London, because the BBC forbade it, but in America, they played the whole 17 minutes of the music. I remember when we landed in New York with Donna Summer, and Neil Bogart, who was the head of Casablanca Records, took us from the airport, put us in a limousine, first time in my life, and switched the radio on, and the radio station was playing Love to Love You Baby. I said, wow, this is it. We made it. To hear a song on the big, important radio station in New York, that was something like confirmation. Okay, that's it. And I only found out later that somebody just called a few minutes earlier saying, Giorgio and Donna is entering the limousine, play the song. But at the time I didn't know, and I believe that that Neil Bogart, being that great salesman, I think he asked for the DJ to play it just that moment when we enter the limousine. I wanted to do an album with the sounds of the 50s, the sounds of the 60s, of the 70s, and then have a sound of the future. And I said, wait a second, I know the synthesizer so well. Why don't I use the synthesizer, which is the sound of the future? And I didn't have any idea what to do, but I knew I needed a click. So we put a click on the 24 track, which then was synced to the Moog modular. I told Tommy, give me 8 notes, which you could adjust. Tong, 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 tong. 8 notes. Dun, 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 dun. And you push one key and it's in C major. Then you push an F and it plays in F or in G or whatever you want. So then we recorded the basic bass, and we had to stop it every 20 seconds because it went out of tune so fast that after 20 seconds it was impossible. So it took us hours and hours because he had to go back and to tune it up again and then drop in and out. So basically I created the snare, the hi-hat, some of the percussion, all with white noise or in the computer. And I took the tracks, went back to Los Angeles, and Donna Summer sang it. And she was not that's interested in writing some special lyrics. And so she said, oh, just I feel love, I feel love, I feel love. Oh, I feel love, I feel love. So we recorded it, and I only noticed later that the juxtaposition of having this electronic sound, this mechanical sound, and her sexy, almost romantic voice would give a nice contrast. So she said, oh, I feel love, I feel love, I feel love, while the bass and the drums were playing. I knew that could be a sound of the future, but I didn't realize how much the impact would be. In 1978, Neil Bogart and Peter Guber were involved with Casablanca and with a film studio, and they played this song, I Feel Love, to Alan Parker. He loved the feel of I Feel Love, and so he asked me if I could record the whole score for the movie. And I said, but I don't have any experience. He said, look, just give me something like I Feel Love. So that was easy, because I had the prototype. I knew what to do. So that's when I did the song The Chase. With Midnight Express, except the song The Chase, the whole recording was done like using the synthesizer like a piano or an instrument. And, you know, I was really happy to be able to tweak a little bit here and to making bow. I wanted something scary. I would do double notes, moving it. And once you free your mind about a concept of harmony and of music being correct, you can do whatever you want. So I just did whatever I wanted. I pushed a chord and I moved it up and down, and I didn't really care. Nobody told me what to do, and there was no preconception of what to do. Well, after Midnight Express, I had a studio at my house in Beverly Hills. There, I had the same as in Munich. I would just go from the living room, from the kitchen to the studio and work. We did one movie called Thank God It's Friday. I think my third or fourth movie was Foxes, with Adrian Lyne as a director and Jodie Foster. And I composed a nice song called On the Radio. Then I did, with Jerry Bruckheimer, American Gigolo, which had the song Call Me with Deborah Harry or with Blondie. And my main movie there was Flashdance. But then it became too busy. I had a friend of mine, Keith Forsey, who started to produce Billy Idol, and Billy Idol came in the house with all his girls and his drugs and his alcohol. So I decided that I'm going to build a studio somewhere else. And then later on, I produced David Bowie, who told me the story about Brian Eno coming with a record and saying, David, I heard the sound of the future, which, coming from a guy like Brian Eno, was the compliment. I had one of those very expensive cars, and I built at that time an incredible sound system. I had 900 watts, and that would be my little studio. You know, I would do a mix in the studio, I would go out in the parking lot, I would check the song with a cassette in the car, see if I still liked it, and then when I would just drive like crazy, I would have it like full power, because not only I spent a fortune in the sound system, but I wanted to hear it. So then, in fact, I had a lot of times when I would be on the street, you have to stop on a red light, and it would blare, and people would, shut up, take it down. When I got the Oscar, I was not surprised, but I still didn't really believe it. When it happened, you know, my stomach started to come up here, and on the way to get the Oscar, I hit a light. I was totally confused. I didn't know how to get up the stage, and then when I had to talk, I had something prepared, but I said some really stupid things. But the experience of going up there was so big. You sit there, you go up there, and then everybody is in front of you. They all look at you, and you know, it's, I'm not used to speak. So when I got the Oscar, that was the final approval of my work, because it's like coming from this little city, dreaming of Hollywood, dreaming of America, and now standing up there, getting the Oscar, looking down Spielberg, all the big directors, the big actors, and I thought to myself, yeah, that's it. And I was kind of not able to talk. It's like it stays here, and thank God there was Dean Martin, who made a little joke, and that helped me a little bit. And I said, thank you very much. And I was so happy to leave. My name is Giovanni Giorgio, but everybody calls me Giorgio.